This is Martha May Newell, January 13th, 1992. Reflections on the Persona's Meaning, auditioned through sound.
She did that. She went to college and went to graduate school. And then she went to Europe, and she worked in 1949 and 1950 with displaced people after the war. And I think that experience was probably pretty interesting. And then after that, she came back to the state of Colorado, where she was born, and she had some empty time before starting a new job in the field of education, and so she went to Aspen, Colorado, and she learned to train huskies. And she did that for a while, and then she ended up for the most part of her adult life in New York City, where she was part of that time the coordinator of training at the C.G. Jung Institute. She was a student at the Institute in New York and graduated in 1981, and has recently decided to retire and spend the rest of her life out here on the West Coast, outside of Portland, Oregon. So we're very pleased to have Martha in our area now, and I'm especially happy that she could come up to Seattle so that you all have a chance to meet her. And now, this is Martha May Newell.
If I sit on this stool, can you all hear me and see me? Well, I'd like to ask you first to join me in a little experiment. Now, all you have to do is to close your eyes for the first part of the experiment and listen, and then open your eyes for the second part and listen again. The question I want you to ask yourself, is there any difference in the two experiences? Now, are you all ready? Think you can handle that? Okay? So close your eyes now. No peeking. Just close your eyes. Listen carefully. Okay. Now open your eyes, please. Was there any difference in the two? Yes. Remember that. We're going to come back to it. Now my topic tonight is the persona and sound. By way of introduction, I'd like to share a few of the following observations. In my experience in training and reading Jungian literature, there are very few references in lectures and publications to extroversion, and even less to the sensation function. Understandably, Jung's approach was compensatory to the extroverted materialistic culture that he lived in, perhaps to a greater degree than we do, as he did live in a more introverted Swiss culture. And I can endorse the necessary compensation, especially for someone like myself. However, I would raise the question, if the extrovert, such as myself, needs to develop a more conscious and differentiated introversion on the path to individuation and towards wholeness, must it not be equally true that an introvert's compensatory development will quite naturally and appropriately lead them to the task of a differentiated extroversion? I bring this up because many of the speakers I've heard, and I imagine it's true for your group too, come from the other side of the fence. There seem to be more introverts, and there certainly seem to be very few people whose major function is a sensation function. So I'd like to represent that kind of openly tonight and bring up some questions that come out of that. While it's rare to find extroversion discussed positively, you would agree it's not rare to find the word archetype. To the rest of the world, we seem to talk of little else. Yet to associate extroversion and archetype is quite uncommon also. More familiar is the association of the archetypal layer of experience with introverted experience. Many assume that contact with the numinosum and the power of the archetypal realm is to be achieved by entrance into an exploration of the inner world of dream, fantasy, image, and imagination. I have the distinct impression that the world of persons, of objects, in advance, is considered a less worthy path to the place of the gods than the royal road that leads inward. We know from our experience that what is given energy is given meaning and value. So it follows that for the introvert, the experience of their subjective reality receives immediate and autonomous value. For the extrovert, in a similar manner, the experience of the object of the world out there receives just as immediate and autonomous a value. So to follow these, we may expect that the most immediate experience of the archetypal layer of reality will self-authenticate itself as subjective for the introvert and as objective for the extrovert. Now, since Jungians tend to be aware of the sins and the dangers of a one-sided extroversion, I'll not dwell further on that side of the polarity, but turn briefly to some of Jung's comments about the problematic nature of introversion. He writes that, quote, introverted consciousness is aware of external circumstances and conditions, but selects subjective determinants as the decisive ones. The introvert's natural suspicion of the relativity of all objective values and phenomena does not also include a similar appraisal of his subjective standpoint. Jung writes, quote, just as the subjective and objective data do not remain permanently the same, being perishable and subject to change, so too the subjective factor is subject to variations and individual hazards. For this reason, the excessive development of the introverted standpoint does not lead to a better or a sounder use of the subjective factor, but rather to an artificial subjectivizing of issues which can hardly escape through reproach merely subjective. This is then counterbalanced by a desubjectification which takes the form of an exaggerated extroverted attitude, unquote. Jung makes the most suggestive comparison of the two attitudes in this sentence. The peculiar nature of the extrovert constantly urges him to expand and propagate himself in every way, while the tendency of the introvert is to defend himself versus all demands from the outside, to conserve his energy by withdrawing it from objects. Therefore, by consolidating his own position, the one achieves his end by multiplicity of relationships, the other by monopoly. Unquote. This contrast between multiplicity and monopoly, between variety and singularity, is relevant not only to the understanding of introversion and extroversion, but also to understanding the meaning of Jung's concept of the persona. When I began classes at the Jung Institute in New York, one of the first classes was one discussing the different aspects of the psyche as Jung described them. There was the anima and the animus, the ego, the shadow, the self with a little s and the self with a big s, and then the persona. I felt that even then, in that class, that they gave a very brief description of the persona that was mostly appearance-oriented, and I was left with a feeling that this wasn't all there was to the persona somehow. And several years later, I decided to explore this aspect of the psyche as a topic for my thesis, and here's some of what I found. In notes written as early as 1912, which led to the publication of the two essays of analytical psychology and the first edition of Psychological Types, Jung described the persona as one of a quaternity, which together with the ego, the animus or the anima, and the shadow, constitute the basic components of the psyche. Although the persona was one of the basic components, it was not listed under a separate heading, but was discussed under the soul as anima. This probably came about because Jung understood the persona and the anima to be in a compensatory relationship to each other. He certainly thought that we could speak of an inner personality with as much justification as an outer personality. He saw this inner personality as the way one behaves in relation to one's inner psychic processes, as the inner attitude, the characteristic face that is turned towards the unconscious. This he called the anima. The outward attitude or face he called the persona. In subsequent writing, the concept of the persona was presented by Jung with varying shades of value and meaning, and from different attitudes, which ranged from an extroverted perspective, viewing the persona as a function of relationship with the outer world, to an introverted perspective, which sees the persona as a deceitful mask, concealing the true individuality, which is essentially inner. Overall, as Dr. Fay Pye of London wrote in 1965 in Harvest, quote, Jung's evaluation of the persona seems almost totally depreciatory, and this view has remained as the generally accepted one in analytical psychology. So join with me tonight as I re-examine Jung's writings about the persona, as well as some other writers, and then I will present a different approach derived from the original meaning of the word persona, as sounding through, and apply the results to the main definitions of persona. In the literature, there's been a great deal more written about the persona as that which is sounded through, the mask, than about that which is sounding through the mask, namely the voice or the sound of the persona. If the persona is one-fourth of our psychic makeup and mediates half of our total experience of others, the other half coming from seeing them, then a thorough understanding is required for analytic work, certainly, and for a comprehensive working model of the psyche. I hope to open a new corridor to you tonight, which can understand the persona and add a new dimension to the model of the psyche as we look at it from a Jungian perspective. First, let me turn to some history on the term persona. The term persona was taken by Jung from the Latin word persona, which originally referred to the mask worn by Greek actors. It also referred to the Roman version of the Trinity, tres personae, una substantia, and is the origin of our English words person, personal, and personality. In many theaters today, we can still see the tragic and comic masks that are hanging in replica above or beside the proscenium arch. The very fact that these masks are still hung and that we still like to be reminded of them indicates we still attach some significance to them. As the mask was used in Greek plays, though, it was not designed to cover up the actor as much as it was designed to convey, to identify the particular role being portrayed by the actor. To do this, the eyes, the nose, and the mouth were accentuated by heavy lines, so the role would be identifiable to all in the audience. The wearing of the mask, of course, predates the Greeks' use of them. In the theater, primitive men used the mask as a magical instrument through which man could relate to the divine in its uniqueness and to the human collective with all of its unknown dangers. Such wearing of masks has always been a magical practice. And as Jacoby states, quote, it has exactly the same effect on us as it had on the primitives, namely a release from fear. With the advance of civilization, the mask became an everyday necessity psychologically, and the actual mask was replaced by certain expressions, manners, ways of talking and being that were used more and more for the sake of man's social environment and conformity to its tastes and requirements. Today we all wear masks, so to speak, in our everyday lives. We may change them in relation to different situations, in relationships, but we lay them aside very rarely. Everyone has the feeling that he does not want to show his real or inner self to casual acquaintances, and in fact, there's a powerful internal resistance that will not let us. And yet, in so many of us, there's a deep longing to communicate the sense of unique, intrinsic being that we possess. But this seldom happens. The falling in love experience seems to be a time when this happens, and yet the eventual withdrawal of the projection, the falling out of love, always brings a great anguish as we return to a state of separateness. Perhaps the ultimate and the true goal of this longing is union with God, in which, in St. Paul's words, we shall be known as we shall know as we are known. By persona, Jacoby believes Jung understands a psychophysical reaction, an attitude that mediates between the inner and outer worlds, a kind of mask we develop to maintain a relatively consistent front to the outside world, through which those we meet may relate to us fittingly. And Jacobi also notes that the persona is the only concept in Jung's psychology which embraces psychic as well as physical aspects, such as how we dress and how we sound. Speaking of sound, I believe we can see the persona as a psychic skin that interfaces between our inner psychic life and the outer world, and it is as essential as our skin is to hold our body together. In Jung's writings, there are three main definitions of the persona. In the first, Jung refers to the mask as, quote, the ad hoc adopted attitude that is a function of relationship exclusively, concerned with relation to objects. The second one says, characteristic of many of Jung's references to the persona, it has a more negative valuation that views the persona as a false self. Though a part of our psychological vocabulary today via the self-psychologists, the false self was used by Jung before many of them were writing, and Jung drew this term from a Japanese sage to support the idea that he wanted to convey about a false self. This Japanese sage was named Naki Toju, and he believed that God is a universal self, while the individual self is the heaven within, something that's suprasensible and divine, and he called it Ryoshi. Ryoshi is God within us and dwells in each individual. It is the true self as distinguished from, quote, the false self. The false self is an acquired personality compounded of perverted beliefs. Jung notes that we might equate this false self with the persona, that general idea of ourselves which we have built up from experiencing our effect upon the world around us and its effects upon us. Jung also quotes from the European philosopher Schopenhauer, who said, quote, the persona is how one appears to oneself in the world, but not what one is. The distinction between what one appears to be and what one is raised the question for me whether our being is to be thought of as essentially inner or outer. David Holt, in his thesis entitled Persona and Actor, observes that Jung speaks as if the further inside we go, the nearer we come to the center of the personality. Phrases like strip off the mask, to divest oneself of the false wrappings of the persona, suggest that the true, the real self, is inner and hidden. A third definition that Jung used tried to draw a distinction between what psychic material could be considered personal and what could be considered impersonal as it applied to the persona. He saw the persona as representing a more or less arbitrary and fortuitous segment of the collective psyche, and that we could make the mistake of regarding it in toto as something individual. Jung maintained that, as the name implies, the persona is only a mask of the collective psyche, a mask that feigns individuality, making others and oneself believe that one is individual, whereas one is simply acting a role through which the collective psyche speaks. Jung finally compromised on the effort to draw a clear and precise line between what was individual and what was collective, and stated that, quote, it is sufficient to know that the human psyche is both individual and collective, and that its well-being depends on the natural cooperation of these two apparently contradictory sides. He concludes that their union is essentially an irrational life process that can at most be described in individual cases, but can neither be brought about, nor understood, nor explained rationally. Now, in Homer's time, the word for actors, the actor's mask, was prosopon, and it was used in the plural to mean the face in the sense of features. As I mentioned earlier, the features were accentuated so that the role being played could be identified even by the back rows in the Greek amphitheaters. In the 5th and 4th centuries B.C., prosopon took on an additional meaning that thought of the actor's mask as being representative of the archetypal power conveyed by the actor. In this conception, the persona and the soul were thought to be conveyed in the actor's mask. Now, there's an interesting and curious fact about these masks. Not only were they made to accentuate the features of a particular role being portrayed, but in the back was a small megaphone carved in the mask to amplify the actor's voice. Thus, the purpose was practical and reflected the desire to reveal, to communicate, not to conceal. It is this information that led me to look further into the meaning of persona. If the sound is included, the per sonare, the sounding through. Almost all the references to the persona in Jung's writings and in more recent articles and books have the persona described in terms of what is seen or what is worn. There are only two that referred to the sound of the persona, to the voice. Now, we live in a time where we can hear our own voice as others hear it. Less than 100 years ago, before Edison invented the phonograph, the only sound we could audition of our own voice came through the inner resonance of vibrations reverberating through the head and chest chambers and the sound that came around to our ears. This incredible discovery of how to reproduce the sound of the human voice, as well as other sounds, of course, has, in my opinion, profound implications for the full understanding of the persona. We now have direct access to what we have projected upon our voices and an additional access to the personal unconscious, known previously only through dreams, fantasies, images, and slips of the tongue. It can be very revealing and instructive to perform a simple experiment with our own voice to illustrate the degree of discrepancy between how we think our voice sounds, how it's made up of how we actually sound, and what we have projected onto our voices, and that what we hear if we tape, record our voices, and listen to that sound. First, write down, if you want to try this out, as carefully as you can, how you think your voice sounds. For example, pleasant, low-pitched, resonant, whatever. Whatever you think, you know, really sounds like. Maybe a little flat, a little, whatever. And then record your voice on a tape recorder and play back the sound of your own voice. Often one is aghast at the actual recorded sound. You think something's the matter with the machine. You know, it couldn't possibly be me. But that's my point, that we really do hear it differently than perhaps we sound. And I'd like to suggest that this difference indicates the amount of the personal unconscious that is present in the sound of the persona but not yet conscious to the ego. The smaller the difference, the more related the ego is to the personal unconscious, especially to shadow aspects, and the freer the ego is to select what qualities of tone will be used in a specific situation.
Can you say that again?
Sure. How far back? The last two sentences? Okay. All right. One is often is aghast at the actual recorded sound and the discrepancy between that which one thought one sounded like and what one actually does sound like on the tape. And I would suggest this difference indicates the amount of the personal unconscious that is present in the sound of the persona, in our voice, but not yet conscious to the ego. The smaller the difference, the more related the ego is to the personal unconscious, especially to shadow aspects, and the freer the ego is to select what qualities will be used in a specific situation. Okay. Now, each human voice is unique in its sound, as revealed in voice prints. Each voice differs from all others in the same way that our fingerprints differ from all others. And in everyday contacts, we hear a voice and assess it in combination with the visual experience of the person with whom we're speaking. The obvious exception would be a telephone conversation where we only hear the other person's voice. I would suggest that there are certain criteria that can be used in assessing the relationship between the sound of a person's voice and the visually perceived aspects of the persona. These three are: 1, appropriateness; 2, congruency; and 3, connectedness. Now, appropriateness is evaluated in terms of the outer situation in which the persona conveys thoughts, feelings, reactions, and sounds that fit the situation. This could be illustrated by the sound of a persona that greets a friend with warmth and enthusiasm, a foe with conscious reserve or abruptness, but speaking with the intent to really communicate that is deemed appropriate. Congruency would be that quality of sound that conveys a suitableness between the inner state of the person and the outer situation. There can be heard a sense of the person coming through honestly and with propriety. Connectedness would be that quality of sound that conveys a viable and lively relationship between inner feelings, thoughts, and experience and the outer situation. There would be a sense of a continuous and related association between the inner reality and the outer reality that is natural, genuine, and spontaneous. Now, we all listen and respond to the tone of voice of others and assess the authenticity of the content of what we hear by how the voice conveys it. We make comments like, "Gee, he doesn't sound like himself today," meaning the sound we've come to associate with this person's persona isn't quite the same. This could be due to illness, some emotional blocking, or a different coloration that we haven't heard in that voice before. Or we can ask with surprise, "Are you the person I spoke to on the phone?" Meaning the person we see doesn't fit with the image we had formed from the sound of their voice on the telephone. A few of you had that happen? Children know how quickly they must respond to a request from a parent, not by the actual words, "Will you come in and wash up for dinner?" but by the urgency, the authority, the intensity of the voice making the request. Now, psychologically, the voice conveys not only the consciously chosen persona quality the ego wishes to use, but it also conveys the contents and the feeling tone of the personal unconscious. This might show in a slip of the tongue or in a feeling tone of dislike that doesn't go with the polite words being spoken. It's from this different perspective on the persona and its accompanying access to the personal unconscious that I would now like to re-examine Jung's main definitions of the persona. In the first definition, Jung refers to the mask of the persona as, quote, "the ad hoc adopted attitude that is a function of relationship, exclusively concerned with the relation to objects," unquote. By including the voice as the sound of the persona, one can observe that whatever attitude is adopted for the moment may be expressed in the voice, and there may be a discrepancy between the adaptation and what the voice conveys. Usually the tone of voice will be determined by what the ego judges is needed in the outer situation. But this can ignore the inner psychic state. If this ignoring is too extreme, the tone of the voice may try to compensate for the imbalance and bring some of the inner feelings into the situation from the personal unconscious, unbeknownst to the ego in its conscious state. An illustration would be a person who is always polite and accommodating, so that we kind of wonder if they ever express irritation. Sometimes the irritation shows in impatience or shortness of answers, in which the content and the emotional tone are at odds. The second definition of the persona that Jung developed saw the persona as a false self. This self is composed of how one appears to the world, but not what one is. But in the auditory, instead of visual terms, the false self is how one auditions oneself and how one concludes the world auditions us. Using the three criteria mentioned before, this would imply that the false self is one that might be appropriate sounding, but neither congruent nor connected with the inner sphere of a person's psychic life. Perhaps this is what is meant by the word hypocrite. The term first referred to those actors who answered and interpreted what was happening in a Greek play. They were kind of the commentators on the side. And later it was used to refer to those who were more concerned with outward show at the expense of inner reality. This is, quote, playing a role or mouthing the lines without access to the power from within to transform the spoken lines into a profoundly moving portrayal of the role, connected to both the outer development of the play and to the inner reality of the actor. Jung may have heard the difference between the persona that conveyed the total person in a relevant way to the moment and the persona that seemed only to show an inclination to, quote, put on official airs or to be playing a social role. But because he used visual imagery exclusively in describing the persona, the crucial difference between visual and auditory aspects of the persona was not identified, namely the sound of the persona. Applying this to analytic work, the analyst needs to give conscious attention to how a person sounds on the telephone when they call for an appointment, and then to how they actually sound and appear, of course, when they come to the office. With the auditioning of sound alone, the analyst can listen for sounds of anxiety, fear, loneliness, anger, resistance, and many other things, and make this a part of the initial assessment of the degree to which the person's ego is aware and related to these feelings. In the third definition of persona, Jung attempted to make a clear distinction between what psychic material could be considered personal and what would be considered impersonal or collective. A new understanding of the relationship between these two can come from a re-examination of the persona as mask. As already noted, the term persona came from the mask worn by the Greek actors. The lines of the features were strongly accentuated, and the mask also had the small megaphone carved in the backside to line up with the actor's mouth. With the help of this tiny little megaphone, the actor's voice could be amplified sufficiently to be heard in the outdoor amphitheaters. From this information, the mask is known to have a twofold purpose. It pictures the role being played by the face of the mask, and it provides a channel through which the actor's voice can be amplified. It is from this latter function, not the former, that the mask receives its name, persona. Through sound, or personare, sounding through. The role is conveyed to the audience through sound, or by the actor's voice sounding through the mask. Now, insofar as the mask can be worn by different actors to portray the same role, it has a collective, common denominator of appearance. But when the mask is actually used, the voice of the actor brings the unique individuality of the particular actor to the role as his or her sound passes through the mask, is amplified by the little megaphone, and is heard by the audience. In light of this understanding of the mask, the visual purpose can be said to be carrying a general collective meaning and the auditory purpose a very individual meaning. Both of these are necessary and crucial to apprehend the meaning of persona. There's a further conclusion that we can make from this understanding of the mask. The mask was worn so the actor could be heard. So it's a reciprocal process, the saying and the hearing. We want to be heard, and it's the persona's function to do that for us. We also want to be seen, and it's the persona's function to do that as well. No one can hear or see into us directly. So we must participate and attend to that process of articulation, a kind of drama, after all, in which we are engaged with each with the other. Mostly this has been thought of as a, quote, narcissistic process in which we seek reflection from others that will define us, rather than an emphasis on penetrating the other, this being the eros function of the persona, rather than the power function of narcissism. I'd like to turn now to some examples of the persona in dreams and myths. We'll try to flesh this out in grounded in some familiar things. In the great majority of references to the persona in Jungian literature, the images and dreams that refer to the persona are what Junsinger calls the cover-ups. Skin, clothing, armor. They may also appear as hats, veils, shields, or take on the characteristics of a profession or trade, such as tools or equipment of various sorts. May also be reflected in an automobile, or even in some cases in a house, or an apartment, or a condominium, and be expressed in awards, ribbons, diplomas, and a variety of so-called status symbols. If we understand the persona as being represented by both visual and auditory symbols, then dreams that deal with sound may be referring to the persona. Here's the dream of a woman in her late 40s. She dreamt, quote, "A lady coming from the left sounds a tuning fork several times. It is very loud and penetrating. And I smile, and she says, 'I'd like to say, I wish she were done.' And I nod yes and smile again. She says, 'I can't smile like that.'" End of dream. The dream focuses upon the lady, who is described only as one who comes on the scene from the left and as one who sounds a tuning fork. Now, anyone who uses a tuning fork is involved in providing a certain frequency of sound to which other tune instruments or prepare to sing. The tuning fork vibrates the same each time, so becomes a universal symbol of a certain quality pitch of sound. We can assume the dream, through the lady and her tuning fork, is addressing some aspect of the persona, that which mediates the relation to the outer world. Now, the orient of the tuning fork is a collective tool which can be used by anyone, and it'll sound the same each time, no matter who uses it. In the dream, the lady does speak, but it's the tuning fork sound that becomes the symbol of the persona. The dream places an odd emphasis on the sound of a tuning fork as loud and penetrating. This is contrary to our common knowledge of the sound of the tuning fork. Can you hear it? I can. A little bit. That's kind of. Okay, but it takes quite a bit, doesn't it? Even when it's struck and placed on a piano sounding board, the sound is not loud and penetrating. So we can conclude that there is something within the orient of a tuning fork, but greatly exaggerated, that is being called to our attention in the dream. Psychologically, the sounding of a tuning fork may be understood to have developed as a defense. If one could get others on their wavelength, on their pitch, this would lessen differences, provide a sense of assurance, and a known atmosphere in which the dreamer could function. There would be a sense of unity that covered over individual differences and gives a sense of relatedness. The dream indicates that the lady knows the dreamer wishes she were done, which the dreamer confirms by a nod of the head and a smile. Thus, the dream indicates that this aspect of the persona that has been sounding a collective tuning fork in order to relate to others is now ready to stop if the ego of the dreamer can understand and relate to the meaning of this symbol in her life. The dream also contrasts the two smiles, one nodding assent to the stated wish that the lady were done sounding her tuning fork, a collective image, and the smile of a genuine individual expression which the lady, as a representative of the collective activity, must admit that she can't do. Psychologically, these two smiles would represent two stages of development and expression, and the dream comes just at that point where the dreamer is being faced with the necessity of looking at the old way with its exaggerated form and is being shown that a new way of being is possible, an individually expressive way. The fact that the dream presents a sound as one of the main symbols appeals to the orient of the sense of hearing. If this dream is considered to be compensatory to a conscious attitude, Then the dreamer's being told to listen, to give attention to this sound, to audition its meaning for her life. Turning now to some of the myths, there are many, that refer to sound and its importance in the relation to the gods and creation. As an example, the myth of the Garden of Eden, auditioned for the significance of sound and the persona, yields some interesting material. The Hebrew poet who wrote about the beginnings of creation chose to represent Yahweh through his voice. Kind of seems presumptuous somehow to call Yahweh's voice his persona, yet this is how he's presented. In the opening verses of Genesis, after the creation of the heavens and the earth, it is the voice of Yahweh commanding, "Let there be light," that calls forth light into the created world. Each successive step of creation is also called forth by the spoken command of Yahweh. Once the Garden of Eden is created, Yahweh admonishes Adam and Eve not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Yet eat they did, and having lost their innocence, they realized that they were naked, and they used fig leaves to cover their genitalia. As Jacoby quipped, the fig leaf was the first persona. Later in the cool of the evening, when Yahweh is walking in the garden, he is referred to by his sound or his voice. It is the voice of Yahweh that asks Adam, "Where are you?" Adam's reply is that he heard the sound of Yahweh and hid because he was naked. It is as if right at that moment, when man becomes conscious of himself as being naked and separate from God, that the spoken voice being heard is born into human experience. In psychological language, the moment of the ego's recognition of its separateness is the moment when it can make its own sound with the intention to be heard and identify itself as different. But in the story of the Garden of Eden, it also portends the expulsion from the garden, from the unconscious state of participation mystique into the opposites of life, outside the garden, and the arduous task of adapting to earthly reality. Here the persona began to form as a mediating factor between the first humans and the outer world. In this myth, then, the beginning of the formation of the persona is inseparable from the beginning of consciousness. In other myths, in both the East and West, sound and tone appear as the heart mother and the fire father of all being. According to the Indian myth in the Mahabharata, creation took place in the silent, unmoving womb of the mother universe. With the first moment and cry, light was created and formation began. In the beginning was the Word. Was the Word outside of time, or was it the very instant of the commencement of time? In Greek, Logos means not only word, but also sound. Light, word, sound, vibration, and thought are linked to the beginning of all knowing, of all naming. Each is sibling to the rest, whether we view it acoustically, philosophically, mythologically, or theologically, and I would add psychologically. There are myths from other traditions that have sound as a central motif. One of my favorites, and one of the simplest, is the legend from Ireland about the gigantic harp called the Harp of Life. The legend says there was a gigantic harp that stretched higher than heaven and went lower than hell. And as the Creator plucked each string, a different creature came forth. What was the sound of the string that brought you forth? Psychologically, this myth gives simple and eloquent tribute to the place of sound in the creation. Each creature had its own string in its own pitch that gave it life. This would mean that there is a sound that is intimately related to the uniqueness of each person, which can never fully be understood because of its beginnings with the harp that extended beyond the limits of man's consciousness. Now, I think I'll take a little break here, and you can stretch and think up your questions. literature, but I've collected a few through my own practice and from some friends. One of Jung's major contributions to the understanding of the psyche was the use of the word symbol. Symbols are everywhere, and they appear in dreams and fantasies, transferences, complexes, images of oneself, of others, even of God. Depth psychology itself, to quote Dr. Ann Ulanoff, is a symbolic system expressing an interpretation of human existence. The symbolic approach has been central in Jung's work and is dictated by the fact that unconscious processes are not directly accessible to our senses. They cannot be seen, touched, heard, or tasted, nor adequately described by the rational categories of causality, time, space, and physical substance that structure our conscious processes and experience. The psyche speaks in symbols, and if we are to understand it, we must learn its symbolic language and enter into symbolic modes of communication. To review a little bit, by symbol, Jung means a non-rational, figurative constellation that points beyond itself to unknown or unknowable objective reality and makes that reality perceptible to us. Hence, the symbol has a mediating function. It makes accessible to our consciousness something that is inaccessible to our direct sensory experience. In Volume 8 of the Collected Works, Jung refers to the word symbol as being taken to mean the best possible expression for a complex fact not yet clearly apprehended by consciousness. The symbol cannot be produced at will, nor can it automatically be translated into some drive, as for example with Freudian or Adlerian theory, where the symbol is reduced to sexual or power drives. For Jung, the symbol must be met in terms of its own details and qualities, its own orient. Even though it's true, as Dr. Ulanoff says, that unconscious processes are not directly accessible to our senses, and the senses are not the receivers for unconscious data, I find myself reacting to what is left unsaid. For me, it's this. I would like to propose that the psyche does take the five senses seriously and uses them symbolically to convey unconscious material into consciousness. Further, I would like to suggest that we each have one function, such as sensation, intuition, thinking, or feeling, that is our major or first function, and so too, we each have one sense that is foremost in our psychic development and usage. Of course, we all use all the senses in varying degrees from birth on to explore the world around us, to warn us of dangers, and to shape our impressions of it. As with the functions, one of the forming influences in our development of our senses is the feedback we receive from those about us, particularly our parents. We each have an original, innate, natural tendency towards one or another of the senses. It could be the one that comes easiest for us, or the one which is most difficult, which would call for extra attention and energy to develop, or what our parents want us to develop. And as we exercise this one sense, a pattern of recognition is set up that others reveal by statements like, "Ask her, she always gets all the details," or, "Oh, he'll do it for you, it comes so easy for him." In this way, we are reinforced in what we do use, and sometimes made to feel ashamed or inadequate for what is not developed as much. Isn't it interesting that the one sense that will alarm parents least is the lack of a sense of smell in their child? And secondly, they may have little or no knowledge of their child's sense of touch, or even their own for that matter. The sense of taste is part of our earliest interactions with our mothers as we are fed, and this can become an issue between mother and child later on when food with a certain taste is refused by the child, but the mother insists it would be, quote, good for them. I'm sure you can all fill in details from your own experience. This leaves two of the senses, seeing and hearing. The two that frighten parents the most if their child has trouble with seeing or hearing. We can imagine the panic a parent feels in that moment when they talk to a baby and the baby doesn't seem to hear, or when a bright toy is passed before a baby's eyes with no sign of response. If one sense is damaged or destroyed by accident or illness, we are familiar with the fact that other senses grow stronger in compensation. But for most of us, the degree of awareness, our consciousness of using our senses, may extend to only one or two, the others continuing to function, but doing so unconsciously. To illustrate, I often hear people in Jungian gatherings say that, well, sensation isn't one of their developed functions. But I would point out that all of us use our sensation function when we drive a car, stop at a traffic light, reach for a sweater when chilly, file a rough nail, season our food, or pause to enjoy a beautiful rose. We may become aware that we did indeed receive the sensate data, but hadn't given it conscious attention when someone asked if we saw Mount Hood or Mount Rainier when it was out yesterday. But we realized we did, but we hadn't given it any further attention. Or when someone asks if we smell smoke, and we find, yeah, we had smelled it, but we hadn't processed the information and considered the consequences. We may hum along with music on the radio, but draw a blank if someone says, what tune were we humming? In relation to the five senses and relative consciousness or unconsciousness of them, we might draw a circle for each one, with a line dividing the proportions of consciousness and unconsciousness for each sense. Try this when you get home. Where would you put your awareness of each of the senses? Which would you rely upon most heavily? Through which do you learn best? Do you learn better by hearing something, or by seeing it, or maybe by a combination? Do you experience an object differently by looking at it, or by touching it? What's the difference? Did you hear the sound of the bell at the beginning of the lecture differently or better when your eyes were closed or when they were open? Which sense brings you more enjoyment than the rest? Is there one sense you feel is least developed for you or least reliable? Is it perhaps smell or touch? The importance of the senses for survival is obvious. For our ancestors, the use of the senses was even more critical when they were exposed to more frequent life-threatening situations. Yet today, some say our sense of smell may be atrophying because of the little use or the few situations where our survival depends upon it. A fire or spoiled food were the only two I could think of. Yet isn't it interesting the bombardment we receive in advertising of scents to bring us almost anything from love to success? I would like to reemphasize that while the senses are not the receivers of psychic symbols from the unconscious, the psyche can use the senses to symbolize unconscious psychic content. For instance, we might have a dream image in which seeing, as symbolized by a microscope or binoculars or glasses, would be the main image. Recently, someone with whom I work dreamt that a friend was going to have cataract surgery. We could also dream of hearing an unusual sound or a voice with a message for us, but no visual image with it. When the psyche does use the symbols as a symbol, use the senses as a symbol, I would like to propose that there are deeper roots than just our everyday field of reference prescribed by the senses, because these senses always refer to our seeing, to our hearing. It's difficult to even conceive of the idea of sight without including our own experience of seeing. This may be truer for the senses as symbols than for any other symbol. We might dream of a tree where we climbed as a child or sat under in the summer to read a book, and we would associate to that tree as being my tree, but it's not quite the same sense of mine as it is for each person as they think about my seeing or my hearing. I don't know whether to say the importance is magnified or increased, or that the senses as symbols are more purely archetypal, but it seems to me that a uniquely personal direction is taken when the psyche decides to use one of the senses as a symbol. What we call the corporeal state of life is based on our having five senses. When we die, we don't have them. So we could say the senses as symbols are archetypes of an individual's individuality and of one's unique aliveness. To illustrate the uniqueness of each person's dream process, I would like to share an experiment conducted by another analyst who had a group of students that he was working with on dreams in various ways. And one of the ways they decided to work with their dreams was to plot the relative depth, this is in quotes, of a person's dreams over a period of time. They developed a rough scale to do this and had seven levels of depth. Then the idea came to them to translate the measurement scale into a musical scale. They did this and began to play these notes on the piano. They called this a person's dream song. At first it was more of a joke and kind of a game, but then they noticed something intriguing. Obviously everyone had a different dream song, but within a particular dreamer they found themes. Perhaps you'll want to audition your dreams for your dream song. I would like to close now with three dreams that use sense symbols, musical and vibratory, to comment in what I found to be a most profoundly moving way about personal and collective levels of experience in dreams. The first dream was dreamt by a woman in her 50s and is as follows. The dreamer is going to a concert with her husband, and they arrive late. Everyone is seated and listening intently, and the dreamer rustles a newspaper in their left hand unintentionally as they go to their seats, and people turn to shh her. They sit down and listen to the concert. Then the music changes beat and picks up in tempo, and the scene changes. The audience changes into ballroom dancers who go from room to room dancing to a different music in each room. As she goes from one room to another, the dreamer sees a shopping bag lady near some stairs and wonders what she's doing there with her raggedy clothes and her brown shopping bags. The dreamer follows the bag lady down the stairs, and as she turns a corner, she sees an old woman playing on a row of skulls suspended on a string between two long bones and being played with two shorter ones. Then the dreamer realizes that the old woman, this collie-like figure, is providing the basic beat for all the different rhythms up above. All that happens above musically is dependent on her primitive beat, unbeknownst to the civilized, fancily dressed ballroom dancers above. End of dream. The second dream of a five-year-old boy came at a time when he was very alarmed with his situation in a foster home, where he was physically abused by his foster mother. He was pushed to understand something about his foster mother, and he had this dream. He goes down into a cave-like place and knows as he goes that he will learn this secret about his foster mother there. When he gets into the big room, he sees in the middle of the area, he sees a huge drum in the middle of the area, and a naked green lady comes out and dances on top of the drum. As she dances, the young warriors begin to sway and to go along with her rhythms. Finally, one of the warriors will be so stirred by the beat that he gets up on the drum and joins her in the dance. Then he will tire, and another will join her. Then one starts to dance with her, but his attitude is too carried away or irreverent, and the lady begins to dance slower and slower, and the dreamer realizes she is trying to catch the dancer's heartbeat. Finally, she does capture his heartbeat and dances slower and slower, until he drops and his heart stops. End of dream. The dreamer knew that he must forever be careful not to get caught like the young warrior did and to avoid letting his foster mother catch his heartbeat. He was relieved to have had this dream and felt it gave him the understanding he needed to go on. The last dream of an Oregon woman tells how healing will take place in the future. The dream begins. A tall woman said she would show me how healing would be done in the future. She took me to a large group of buildings, very well tended and lit. We walked down a corridor and turned right into a room. There were a number of people, 20 or so, listening to tapes with headphones. As I walked in between them and could hear what they were listening to, one tape said, "This is a compulsion," another was talking about defenses, another about the shadow, so on. Then she said to the dreamer, "This is education. The first thing that needs to be done is to give appropriate tapes to each person relevant to them and let them study. Now I will show you where the real healing is done." We walked down this hall to the back of the complex and into a room where a woman sat with some machinery or mechanism beside her. This is where the healing is done. There was a table, and it had 5 amethyst crystals on it. One of the clusters was quite big. The person picks up one of these amethyst crystals that they have an affinity for. Then she explained that they now have the technology to reduce it to its essences. We put it through this processing machine, and it comes out on a silvery tape, and these are put on various parts of the body and had a certain electromagnetic field. The body responded to the essence, and this is how healing will take place in the future. End of dream. Thank you. If I would identify who Jacobi was, I can only tell you that she was a woman who worked with Jung in the early days of his work in Zurich. Maybe someone else here knows more about her. She's written several books. That's where I came across her in some of the readings. So, and, no. She died in 76. She was an analyst that was trained by Jung and practiced in Zurich as. Okay, as Kate said.
You're more of a best of
few. One of the few, right? Thank you. Now don't tell me you understood all this. Okay, there we go. That did it. Come on.
I'm very curious what it might mean when you're hearing the music. When there's beautiful melodies, different things that happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's like any other symbol, as I mentioned in terms of the senses. This is a symbol that you hear instead of see. You might touch a symbol too. In working with people, I would usually ask what they associate with that music, if it's familiar, if it's a tune you know. It's not anything you recognize, right? Just pretty music, huh? Well, sometimes it's pretty hard to get at it in... I have some material from a man in New York who was a math teacher and musician, played the organ and piano, and he always, almost 95%, dreamt in musical symbolism, not the score, but the actual music. And he found it helpful, because it was things that he could identify, to go back to whatever was going on in the composer's life at the time they wrote this particular piece of music. That was one of the things that he found useful. I don't know, any other suggestions or comments on how many of the, yeah?
Did she ever remember the tune?
No. No. Yeah. And?
So it's really see if I can, you know, try to write it down.
I think sometimes it is important to just live with and contain and hold a symbol, even if it's in musical form, as long as you can and kind of see where it's going. And maybe it goes to waking up and then you'll come back to it the next night. But yes, there was a question back there.
Before I can kind of say it, you know, kind of a false thing.
I understand. I think I understand what you mean, that the origin of the symbol is in the psyche anyhow, and it's projected out onto whatever is out there.
Yeah, and that's almost all illusion, because there isn't.
Yeah. Okay, but the form that it has that could be drawn or referred to is the same as the process of seeing or of hearing, where there are things we associate and use in connection with those, like glasses to see with, binoculars, these kinds of things. These have to do with seeing and only with seeing. So I mean it in the sense that things that are associated with the different senses, I think the senses themselves can actually be used as symbols too, but I was also referring to the things we connect with them as being used by the psyche to refer, yes, to that inner process, but also to what is happening out there. Depends on how the symbol appears in the dream. Does that help any?
Yeah.
Vaguely, huh?
I didn't get that.
Yeah. Yeah, but the goddess is... No, I don't think so. In that case, the goddess is the symbol in that example. And the scene is the process of perception. Yeah, go ahead, Ann.
I can give you one simple example of a perfect dream that shows what a sound as a symbol might mean. I had a dream of being totally myself. And all it was photographs. And in the dream, I was so inside there and so at peace. And, you know, I couldn't hit it too. And I wanted to get up and describe it all and put me get back up to the world. There's nothing else but that when we can. And it was totally illuminated about myself. And it had nothing.
That might be the tone that the harp plucked when you arrived. Huh? Yes. Are you asking, do introverts have certain senses that are more developed and extroverts have others that are more developed? It may have been, but I don't know the answer. My guess would be it's pretty well evenly distributed. Because I can think of people in the introverted category who are all the different functions and the same, and and I don't really know what the proportions are. There's no question but what Jungian analysts worldwide come out more introverted, intuitive. They do have documentation for that, but I don't know about the rest of the population. Anybody else know? If there's any correlation between introversion having certain senses that are stronger and extroversion having certain senses that are stronger. Yeah?
How does one map the order of preference of the senses to the unconscious?
They're not at unconscious.
Well, of the...
Of the ones least developed?
No, of the ones that you're personally, of your unconscious are using to speak to you. You're saying consciously you have a hierarchy of senses that you use, and unconsciously there may be different hierarchies.
Huh,
how
right.
Do one map the hierarchy of the unconscious so you can understand the importance of the information?
I don't know, I guess make a little chart and jot down which ones, you know, which ones occurred in which dreams, you know. Yeah, I think you'd want to know how frequently do they come up, in what ways are they used. I mean, you know, be a little analytic about it.
In dreams?
Yeah, yeah. You know, how many dream in color? Okay, how many never dream in color? Okay. Just about two, not, and the rest do. So I mean that. You can't map it with conscious intention without having some data. And the data will come in dreams or fantasies or whatever. And so then you extract that particular thing from it. I think it would be very interesting to do. Good question. Yeah. Others? Well, I want to thank you. Yes, there's one more. Mm-hmm. Yes, we live in a really visually oriented culture. You know, we don't really put very much emphasis on what we hear. That's, I think, why the volume's been turned up in recent years on all kinds of things. So hopefully it'll make a dent, but I think it's only detrimental, you know, much of the time. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, but I think everybody prefers one or another of them, whether they're sensates or not. Yeah. And it has to do with how they can learn. Yeah. Yeah, Louise?
Well, one question, I think it fits right in here. Would you comment on why that bell sounds different with your eyes shut or...
Okay, you tell me.
it sounded different with my eyes closed.
Right.
And so that's probably because I use my eyes and don't hear.
They even have the actual percentage of energy that goes into seeing that is taken away from hearing in terms of neurological activity. It did, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, we have some people in the front rows here who've heard the sound louder with their eyes open than with their eyes closed. Okay? Oh, we got a lot of response to that, right. Much clearer, okay? Well, we haven't heard from you all. How did you hear it? Louder with your eyes open. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What about those of you that had your hands up back there? Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Yes.
I thought it was a more complete experience than my dream, and it felt like it touched all of my being with my eyes closed as opposed to all of the bell.
I had the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think with that response, let's hear it once more, and you can either close them or open them, whatever you'd like, and we'll close with that, okay? You can try it both ways if you want. Any difference? Okay. Take that with you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.